Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I think that Power and Glory should have been tag team champions. I think that Arn Anderson had the best DDT in wrestling history. And as for the WWE Network, the WBF pay-per-view called and said that number sucks.
Hi, I'm G. John Chase, and I think China made the right decision going back to porn instead of sticking with TNA. I thought Black Rain was a better gimmick than Goldust, and I was the guy that helped beat up and kidnap Samoa Joe.
I'm Carl Jones, and did you know that when they were looking for inspiration for their ring attire, Demolition found it by raiding my wardrobe? My go-to dance move is the Garvin Stomp, and much like Cowboy Bob Orton and Abdullah the Butcher, when my blood boils, I should come with a medical warning.
Hi, this is Kieran O'Rourke. I've got to be honest with you, I'm not really sure what all the fuss is about, because this fucking company, TNA, should have died after 6 weeks. It's still going. The most incompetent company in the history of professional wrestling. It's not going to die. It's going to turn up in Britain or something stupid as a national professional wrestling company on the BBC. It's going to drive me fucking insane!
This is the panel for the 9th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the highs and lows of TNA wrestling next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 9th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. This is Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Hello.
Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening.
And Carl Jones.
I can get enough of the adrenaline rush.
And on that perfect note, we are here today to talk about the highs and lows of TNA. This is obviously a podcast that's been brought on by current events. Just kind of briefly backtrack before we get to the highs and the lows and the concept of this podcast. As Sunday night bled into Monday morning this past week, it was publicly revealed that Spike TV will not be renewing the TNA wrestling contract. So basically, this looks like dire straits. Shit Creek for TNA, I believe, is what they call it. TNA has 2 months to basically find a contract that pays as well as Spike did before they have to close their doors, because no other contract is going to pay them anywhere near as much. Now, we're going to get to the highs and lows. This isn't supposed to be necessarily a eulogy of TNA, but current events dictate that that actually might be the case. So before we actually get to the highs and lows, I want to thank everybody for the feedback they've sent. And there's a hell of a lot to talk about with a topic covering a company 12 years long. And again, we're going to go straight to the feedback. Lust Hogan from Pro Wrestling Only. A throwback to Jesse Ventura there. And hi to Terry Tyrell and Jane back in Minnesota. Hi. Angle versus Joe. The series was really good, and the final pseudo-MMA match at Lockdown, I believe, was great and was being praised for being innovative. TNA did a good job with the build and really seemed like an alternative to WWE for one night.
Yeah, I was going to say, when we were looking about this this topic for the podcast anyway, that this was going to be one of the, kind of the things I was going to first came to mind for me. I was actually at the show. What show was it?
It was No Surrender.
No Surrender, when they actually played the video and made the announcement that Kurt had signed. I think it was like a week after he'd been fired.
It was like 3 weeks after he'd been fired. Everyone believed he had a no-compete clause. Yeah. People were talking UFC with him.
I was at that live. I used to obviously go to Orlando once a year for about 6 years. So I used to go and watch the free shows, because, hell, free's free. Yeah, it was an amazing atmosphere to be amongst. I mean, it was incredible. It was so intense. It was real. What emotion, because that crowd in that the Orlando crowd, it was such. As an outsider going to watch it, you could see how it was such a insular, self-contained fan base. They were, none of them were paying. It was like, yeah, it was their local indie, basically. They were going to watch. It's like the thing to do on a Thursday or whatever day they filmed. But I mean, that was true proper wrestling emotion. It was amazing. It was one of the best wrestling incidents I have been live for. And yeah, following on from that, the relative success they had with the angle and Joe to start with, it was, I'd say, absolutely the best individual feud they've done in that day.
So. In terms of series of matches, historically speaking, from a buyout perspective, I believe all the biggest ones they ever did, if I'm not mistaken, were Angle, Joe. Just before we move on the Kurt Angle point, because obviously the debut of Kurt Angle is one of the bigger moments in TNA history. And like you said, being there live, there was something interesting that you mentioned to me a few years ago when you were recounting the story of being there live for Angle's video playing when they announced that Angle was coming. You were telling me that in the line, when people queue to get in, everybody's talking about WWE. The TNA fans are all talking about WWE, like that's the real show. Yeah. Even if they're there to support, you know, knowing their role, chanting, this is awesome, and hoit, hoit, hoit.
Oh, bloody Lance Hoyt. Yeah, well, because they used to drink with him in the bar afterwards.
Exactly.
It was a false atmosphere, because they're almost employees, the fans, to a degree. I mean, but WWE was the big league, there's no doubt about it. That was professional wrestling. That was what they look up to and aspire to, I guess. And yeah, it was that was a big league, and it was so apparent, smacked you in the face. And I thought it's such a strange, unique crowd to be amongst, to see that there wasn't a real affinity towards the characters or the storylines. They were there because it was free. It was the thing they did as friends, I guess. And yeah, it isn't, you know, I guess it's wrestling audience and society in that town, and they, you know, come together and it's their thing to do. But it wasn't there wasn't real emotion connected to the product. It was tangible, if you could feel it.
So. But for that one moment when Kurt Angle's video played,
maybe it was because that felt like they were in the big leagues and an actual proper star was going to be. Yeah,
I will say, in terms of highs and lows, I assume that you were going to pick Kurt Angle's debut for the high.
Yeah, the actual
and that video. That is your high, and we'll get to your low shortly as well. But I was actually very curious, because I was thinking myself of saying the high Kurt Angle signing, and the low that same week Vince Russo was re-signing. So I remember being on the telephone with you when you were in Orlando and saying that they're saying there's a big surprise going on, but we don't know what it is. In other news, Vince Russo's just been re-signed with the company.
Oh, that is a surprise.
Yeah, it's almost as if you sort of got the darkness and the dawn with all encompassing in one week. I mean, anyone who knows me knows my views on Vince Russo aren't the most complimentary. When we're going through lows, I dare say Vince Russo will be involved somewhere along the way in this podcast.
I would imagine the beginning, the middle, and the end, and a lot of it.
I think in terms of, you know, the actual high that he's talking about, the Angle and Joe feud, I think the only issue I'd have, I'd agree that it is a high, the only issue I'd have with that feud was that they did it way too soon after Angle had debuted. It was literally right away. It was the first feud they got into, and
the first time you ever saw Kurt Angle live in the building was the admittedly exciting and crazy confrontation with Joe, where TNA did feel major league.
Yeah, I mean, they probably could have done that, like that initial confrontation, if they wanted to, but like they should have built that. They should have spent at least a year building that confrontation, and they should have had other people face Angle first, build that feud slowly. But instead, they just hot shotted. They wanted obviously to please the fans straight away, and they just hot shotted that feud, and that's the only negative I'd say about it.
And again, go back to that whole Russo coming in the same time as Angle did. Again, they blew through three matches in 3 months. They completely just shot through it like a rocket. And then the actual Angle itself, the storyline between Joe and Angle, just kind of went to hell.
One thing I would completely agree with, whilst the in-ring stuff was excellent, and that would come as a surprise to no one, it's Joe and Angle. Everyone knew how good the in-ring stuff was going to be. They completely shot their load.
Yeah, they really
did. With that feud. It was over in the blink of an eye.
Ultimately culminated in the lockdown cage match, which Lust Hogan mentions here. Doing that completely different, unique MMA style. Angle coming out in the board shorts with his ankles taped. Completely different style, completely different look. Completely different build, which did the biggest buy rate in like TNA history for Joe's title win. And then they never did anything like it ever again. Is there anything more emblematic of TNA than that? They struggle for years to do anything right. They finally do, and they never do anything like it ever again.
But that just sums it up.
The funny thing in probably hindsight, because I was the one that said that they should have done it a lot later, but probably the thing in hindsight, it's actually probably a good thing that they did it as soon as possible, because, I mean, how long did Joe remain relevant after that? I mean, the fall of Joe kind of came quite swiftly after that. So at least we got that feud whilst Joe was a somebody, as opposed to them doing it down the line after they buried him.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the... and it's... They shouldn't be given any credit for that, because it's their own fault. Why? But I think the stain of TNA would have got to them eventually. So maybe they would never have done 60. Maybe they would have topped out. Hypothetical.
Individually around the table, we've all had in our own minds our individual high and low. Lust Hogan agrees entirely with Kieran's high and low, because for his low, the Hogan and Bischoff regime. When they came, there was a buzz and optimism and a chance for real change, but it quickly became all about Hulk and Bischoff. They seemingly had a bunch of good ideas, but really didn't want to listen to fans, which made people ultimately quit caring together. And I know, Kieran, for your low, certainly not high, was the Monday Night Massacre featuring TNA v WWE.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not... This isn't coming as a surprise to anyone, which makes the decision to do it all more stupid, because I think everyone knew what was the outcome was going to be. It was the golden character. They were always dangling these little golden carrots in front of, you know, we get this and we're going to be, we'll move on up, and it's
only we get two hours.
And what the fuck did they think was going to happen going ahead with Raw? Fucking insane! And it's, all it did was show to probably the Carters themselves, although obviously Dixie didn't really learn that much of a lesson, that they were never going to be. Maybe the fan base, maybe just Scott, took away that. We couldn't suspend our disbelief that TNA could be anything more than a piece of shit, false ass, wannabe wrestling promotion.
They go on, they did the first Monday Night War, the January 4th special, where they did a 1.5. From 0.9 to 1.1 to 1.5 is still growth.
Okay, yeah.
However, the lowest, if I recall, was the day after WrestleMania, where TNA did a 0.5 for their... Yeah, so it was very quick, very apparent, very quickly. And the thing, too, is... I mean, they were still trying to find themselves the entire time through that Monday Night War, and I use that term very liberally in this case... Because they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. It was a complete overhaul of the product. Hogan and Bischoff bring in Orlando Jordan, the Nasty Boys, Bubba the Love Sponge. Yeah.
Don't forget Bubba.
Yeah.
Don't forget Bubba.
I mean, there's so many. I'm sure Kong doesn't. There's so many. Elements to that, to the Bischoff Hogan regime. Yeah. The money spent, the trash they brought in. But yeah, I mean, there's so many. But for me, the biggest, for me, as looking at the company projection overhaul, I think that overall that was. It's been downhill since then. It's been a slow death since then. Because that, I said, I guess maybe the realization there was no more golden character. Then they maybe it's just a survival. They entered survival mode maybe years ago. But that for me, that's just because that as a point in terms of you take away the fantasy of what your company can be, how you present yourselves. From that point on, there was no doubt in anyone's mind. Surely anyone who still believed that it was anything other than a second-rate company. So,
if I could just pose a quick question to you, Kieran. It's Hogan Bischoff is your low point, but did you go into it expecting any highs to come from it? Because I say, speaking personally, when I heard that they'd been announced, I thought, okay, there'll be a bit of interest there, but I didn't really expect much of it. So me personally, I wasn't disappointed by it. It was very much this is what I was expecting to happen.
That's exactly why it's my low point, because for me it's completely fucking obvious what was going to happen, and the long term of it as well. Even get to this point right now, it was an inevitability from that point on, because the man behind the curtain's been exposed. That's not the right phrase, but you get the point, people. I think that was it. It was such a stupid move to on so many levels, from a business, financial, No.
The other thing with me for this is, I was so sick of Russo's television for those previous 3 years, 3.5 years of just fucking dreadful impacts every fucking week with a really good roster. By the time Hogan and Bischoff were announced, I was just happy to see something different, because I was so frustrated. It was worse when I don't know if it was worse, but it was as bad, if not worse. It needed a change when Hogan and Bischoff come in. Hogan and Bischoff weren't the right change, and everyone knew it, but I was just something different, something to fucking happen, because it was just on a treadmill.
Of course, like Vince Russo's obviously putrid with his run, but at no point, even with Bischoff and Hogan coming in, at no point did I think, oh, well, at least it's going to be a different type of putrid. You know, it was going to be going to be putrid. It's just a different type of evil, that's all.
Okay, so moving on. Craig Atkinson, Joe AJ Daniels at Unbreakable is the high. Low point was allowing Jeff Hardy to main event a pay-per-view while clearly plastered. This is one of the more frequently appearing low points, obviously, and high points for that matter too, the Unbreakable AJ, Joe and Daniels, you know, that entire run. But just to get to the low point, because we can get to the good stuff later, Jeff Hardy, main eventing Victory Road, very quick match against Sting. That incredible shot when the camera moves in on him on the introduction. He's got this silliest fucking grin on his face. It's amazing. I can't... The fact that no one got fired for that is absolutely shocking.
That is the shocking thing. People should have lost jobs because of that. For a company that always wanted to see itself as competition, and at the very least as the number two, which it was by default, nothing else... That is so Bush League. Bush League.
The worst. Yeah, that was definitely the low point of TNA when it comes to, as a business aspect, as you know, supposed to be a professional business, to actually allow someone like Jeff Hardy in that condition to go out was certainly the lowest point.
A guy in that state getting dropped on the back of his head by a Sting with a Scorpion Death Drop or whatever it was. Yeah, as brief as the match was, just completely fucking irresponsible. He's fucking falling over himself as he's climbing the stairs.
I suppose we could tie this into the Kurt thing as well. It's, I think, we've kind of all. Oh, yeah. You know, kind of, in the back of my mind, was petrified that he was going to die on their watch or something.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, and that's actually the one thing that we completely missed about Kurt Angle joining TNA. WWE fired him because they were afraid he was going to die on their watch. They fired Kurt for that reason. TNA just snaps him right up. And it's so funny listening to different radio shows from that period of time when it happened. Because on one hand, Sunday Night Submission, which Carl, you and I used to listen to a lot, they were all excited about, you know, we're going to see Angle and Joe. We're going to see Angle and Styles. Meanwhile, Brian Alvarez is saying, TNA, what a bunch of assholes. Just a bunch of fucking assholes, because they know how bad this is. 3 weeks after he's fired, they pick him up. Same with Jeff Hardy. Gets fucked out of his face, no regard for himself. Let's put him out there.
Maybe we should give him a pass in that respect on Kurt, because I think there's no doubt about it that their schedule helped him.
Oh, yeah.
It's obviously that, you know, WWE...
It worked out.
So, and he hasn't died yet, touch wood. Yeah, so maybe they... So I'd say maybe give him the benefit of the doubt on that one bit. But still, it was, you know, questionable decisions, desperate decisions by a company that... no moral obligation or apparently
or Simpson. Morals in general,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, it probably actually still is a questionable decision just by the fact that WWE have no interest in signing Kurt Angle as a competitor.
Okay, so something savage from Pro Wrestling Only. Hi, 2011, basically everything post Jeff Hardy drug induced main event versus Sting, through all of 2012 and possibly up until lockdown 2013. Hogan as GM wasn't as bad as you might think. Concepts like Open Fight Night, the mandatory defending of the television championship, and even Gut Check were at least unique in theory, and even turned out alright in execution more often than not. They put on a string of solid pay-per-views with Aries, Jeff, Rude, Storm, and others contributing, the emergence of Bad Influence as a tag team, the refocusing on the X Division, and a serious upgrade in production values took place throughout this tenure as well. Low. Definitely most of 2010, and a lot of the terrible gimmick matches and stipulations they cooked up simply for the sheer desperate sake of seeming different. I will say the mandatory defending of the TV championship lasted 3 weeks exactly. I'm not sure if Gutcheck really ever brought about anything that was
never.
Any good. Open Fight Night. Whatever. It is what it is. It doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, because I think when we were talking about this, earlier this week, I think I did mention there was like a short period of time. Where it was about 4 or 5 weeks, very short period of time, where TNA was actually pretty good.
It was when they started going live.
Yeah, and it, I think it comes about around about that period that he was talking about. But I'm sorry, I'm going to disagree about the whole Gut Check thing. I mean, that whole...
We can get into the Gut Check later on, because there's more on the Gut Check, trust me.
Okay, I got a lot to say about Gut Check.
In practice, those concepts never really worked, and I don't really think they were ever fully embraced, if we're honest. I mean, you mentioned about the mandatory... TV title defense there, was it 3 weeks you said?
Yeah,
that's not exactly a glowing endorsement for something, because that's not putting your full weight behind something.
No, here's another one for you. Remember when Hogan and Bischoff were running the show, and they did that thing where they had like the fans would vote for the number one contender every week on Impact, and Nigel McGuinness, because it's an internet vote, Nigel McGuinness in a landslide wins. They job him out immediately. The next week, they do it again. Nigel wins again in a landslide. They drop him out again. The next week, they just fucking drop it completely. What a fucking... Why?
Stupidest wrestling company in history.
Unbelievable.
Ever.
Ollie Williams, and this coincides with Carl's high. The high was the initial Samoa Joe run, acting as an unstoppable submission machine and the Joe's gonna kill you chance. Carl?
What was that young gentleman's name?
Ollie Williams. Who does not do the Blackie weather forecast, by the way.
Damn. I was just going to say, that's another talent to his bow there. Feel free to email in any time you want, Ollie. I loved the initial Joe run and sort of all that it encompassed. We've already talked about the triangle matches.
Yeah, the reason why I skipped past that is because I know this was coming, yeah.
Yeah, which... how many pay-per-views did they do that match on?
The three-way,
yeah.
They did a singles, they did the Ultimate X later, the year afterwards, and then they ended up doing it again in 2009 when I believe AJ was the champion.
But no, you had those great matches. Joe looked legitimately like a killer during that run, and you thought, this is something that gives you hope, because this is someone they've taken from Ring of Honor, who had notoriety, and they're actually doing something with him. They're making this work. And it pales in comparison to everyone else that they've picked up since then. And I think it really, you know, it really sort of crystallises just how bad some of their subsequent hires have been and the way they've been treated. And obviously it built up to the Angle feud, which we've talked about to a large extent. And I loved, this is probably something that will be missed off by a lot of people, but the one bit that I really loved about Joe's run, And it's just a tiny bit. When he has the tag match with Sting against Jarrett and I think it's Monty Brown. I could be wrong. They have the tag match on the pay-per-view. They do that horrible sort of build-up where Sting's doing his shooting
things.
Jarrett and Steiner, my apologies. And they bring out Bagwell.
And
they
Luger.
Bring out Luger's helped to the ring. It's a real goddamn yeah. car crash. Then when he announces Joe, and I think that tapped in a little bit to sort of a real emotion, because they really did hook them with Joe being the tag partner, because he'd built up such air to steam. And the way the match ends, obviously Joe gets the win, it's a big deal, and then they double team Sting, the dumbest baby face in the history of wrestling. And you it's a great image of Joe walking up the ramp, the camera's over his shoulder. I think Liam knows where I'm going with this. And he hears the guitar shot on Sting's head. He just turns around, looks, and shrugs his shoulders and just walks off. And you thought, there is a badass. This is the guy that's going to lead the company. Little did we know how that would turn out eventually when he got his hands on the belt. That was a whole other story. But just for that 18 months, there was something that seemed legitimate, that seemed to work, something that seemed to click with the audience.
And one thing that I do want to mention here and highlight a little bit, that my favourite part of this entire run was there was a match where Joe and AJ were in the final of like an X Division Cup, I believe, and they had like an awesome match on a pay-per-view, just a fantastic match. And it was clear then that this guy has what it takes to build the whole company around him.
Well, just to that point you mentioned building the company around, look at the bit with the match they had with Steiner.
Yeah.
Scott Steiner, real...
Oh, Steiner's real, promo,
yeah, real damaged goods coming off his WWF run. People actually cared because he was with Joe. Just for a brief moment, people cared about Steiner again.
Yeah.
I think what actually kind of helped Joe, at least in those first couple months or anything, was... I think they actually did hone in the whole fact of his run in Ring of Honor as well, because obviously a lot of people who watched TNA were, you know, more likely watching other things on the indie scene, yeah. particularly Ring of Honor. And so I think that whole, that long Ring of Honor world title reign that Samoa Joe had, I think that translated over to TNA. So like it wasn't like they had to build him up. It was like he was already kind of pretty established.
He was a star the second as soon as
he debuted at, I think it was Slammiversary against Sanjay Dutt, I think like straight away they knew who he was, they knew what his history was, and they knew that he was a badass. So they were able to run with the ball straight away.
Ollie Williams, for the low point, mentioned the Monday night debut and focusing so much on Hogan, all the talent, and no building on the talented roster they already had, agreeing with you, Kieran. Steve Pachenik, the best thing TNA had was fortune. AJ Styles, Kazarian, and Beer Money could have carried that company for a good term, but creative broke them up way too early.
Fortune 4!
I knew you were going to do that. But creative broke them up way too early. As far as a low point, I turned TNA off as soon as Hogan was brought in. Fortune, what are your thoughts on this? This kind of ties into a greater theme with TNA.
That was quite a kind of convoluted stable at first, because I mean the four names that you mentioned there, they weren't the only four that were in Fortune. They did have other members as well at first, didn't they? They had like Doug Williams in there, and they had Matt Morgan as well, and Ric Flair was the manager. Yeah. So at first that stable was a bit of a fucking mess until they finally established who the four guys were going to be, the four horsemen.
Well, that's the thing, I think that's what you're leading to, isn't it? The fact that TNA, on so many occasions, has just been a parody company of whether it's stealing angles or gimmicks or... fucking amateurs.
Amateurs.
And Kieran's the positive member of the table.
Grimace from Pro Wrestling Only. Hi, Joe's run from his debut, he was booked as a monster and the future ace, went through everyone and had great matches with the X Division guys and Scott Steiner, among others. This brings a...
Grimace, you bring a smile to my face.
Low, the pay-per-view before Bound for Glory, which is the one that Kieran was at, Joe faces Jarrett in a non-title strap match, wins, and the main event of Bound for Glory is Sting v. Jarrett for the title. What stupidity! Just have Joe win the title there and things would have made perfect sense.
What a stupid fucking company.
Yeah, it would have made perfect sense, and that's why TNA didn't do it.
The Chief from Pro Wrestling Only. I will say this. If I'm booking a dream North American promotion, I'll take the production of WWE, the episodic TV of Mid-South, the talent of Crockett, and maybe some of the early edge of ECW. There isn't a damn thing I would take from TNA.
No. What about Christy Hemme as a ring announcer? Or at least just Christy Hemme to look at.
Oh, you're easy. You're so easy. God.
Nails on a damn chalkboard and you know it.
Brad Hindsight from Pro Wrestling Only. His high, the lockdown cage match between AJ Styles and Abyss from 2005. Low, the Jeff Hardy situation with Sting. AJ and Abyss from lockdown is a really, really damn good cage match.
There was a lot of good stuff in 2005.
Yeah, I mean, 2005 was...
Would you say that was AJ's best year with the company?
2005?
In terms of in-ring work?
Yeah, AJ Styles' 2005 was probably the best year he did have. I mean, if you look at the start of the year when he had the triple threat Ultimate X match with Pete Williams and Chris Sabin, which was an excellent match.
Yeah.
And then I think it was the following pay-per-view Against All Odds when he had the 30-minute Iron Man match against Christopher Daniels. I think I'll probably say 2005 might have been probably around about the last time that Abyss was any good as well in that company.
We have polarizing thoughts on Abyss, so we'll get to him later on, believe me.
I thought he had virtues to begin with, but they quickly faded.
Lost from Pro Wrestling Only, perhaps my favourite feedback of all. I think 2002 to 2014 was a real low point for TNA.
we could just end the podcast there at this point.
That might be the last. I should have read that last.
Yeah.
Actually, to be fair, I always thought they were really good at naming some of their pay-per-views. Bound for Glory.
That's a great pro.
Victory Road and Slammiversary are pretty strong pay-per-view names. That's all I got, though.
I will say this. At least he's being very pragmatic about the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Not in the Battle comes to mind. If I was actually to take that comment seriously, none of those names were any good. Slammiversary is a horrible name.
I like Bound for Glory.
Maybe stretch at that. Victory Road?
No. Bound for Glory is a good name. It just doesn't match TNA.
Yeah, I guess.
Who gives a shit? They were promoted terribly.
That's the name of the last shit. Here we go. Concrete 1992 from Pro Wrestling Only. Hi, Austin Aries' Destination X win for the title against Bobby Roode. Thoughts?
It had an element of shock value, I suppose. Sure. So it gets a pop in that sense, but it came from nowhere. You know, it wasn't built up. So to me, it just didn't really mean anything when it happened. It was quickly forgotten about.
Yeah, I think... at the moment, it did have that great... shock value, as you were stating, but I also remember when I watched that show, I also thought, they've kind of fucked up Bound for Glory now.
Yeah, totally.
Because they were, if I remember right, I believe they were building, at least initial plan was they're building for Bobby Roode's Storm.
Yeah,
to
the
be
year
the Bound
long
for Glory.
Plan,
yeah. And by obviously by changing the title over to Aries, that just threw everything out. I mean, Roode and Storm still happened, but it now there was no title on the line.
Nothing.
And I think who did Aries face?
Jeff Hardy.
Jeff
Hardy won the Bound for Glory series, won the belt back.
Yeah.
Bang for Glory. I was never a fan. How do you guys feel about the league table format?
It never made any goddamn sense. Half the time, they just didn't know. I think there was one year, I can't remember which one it was, but there was one year where... All the opponents didn't have the same amount of matches, and so they all had a different amount of points. And so someone won who had like 12 matches over someone who had like 15 or something. It was like really weird.
It's not like you have to rewrite the rules of a round robin to get it over, you know? I echo your sentiments there, G. I think that as cool as it was for Aries to win, and the crowd did love it because Aries was being built up for quite a while, consistently on pay-per-views, going over all the time, it was the wrong time to do it. And James Storm was a massive casualty that year.
Yeah, it was definitely, as I said, it was definitely one of those things where at the time I was like really happy about it because I was happy for Austin Aries, but then it quickly dawned on me that they just screwed the pooch with their version of WrestleMania.
Side bottom from Pro Wrestling Only. A high for me was seeing their toys in stores when I was shopping for my nephew's Christmas presents. If he was into wrestling, sadly not, I'd have loved to have gotten him a Samoa Joe figure or whatever. TNA had a ton of toys, which was nice to see, around 2006-2007. Also, the graphics on their video game looked amazing at the time. Shame the game was rotten, if not slightly apt.
is that the best backhanded compliment of the podcast?
I think it might be.
But in terms of the video game, I actually did unfortunately buy TNA Impact.
Yeah,
and yes, he was right, it did look great. But I just remember this whole freaking like ad campaign they were doing where AJ Styles and Samoa Joe and Christopher Daniels, they were helping develop this game by doing all the photorealism and everything, and so really getting hyped for this game. This is going to be better than the SmackDown game, surely. And then when it actually came out, first off, the roster was 2 years out of date. And so, like, half the people that were in the game weren't anymore, and the people who you wanted in the game weren't in it. And the game just sucked ass. It was just count holes after count holes. And then you had the absolute, like... The putrid storyline of suicide, which they then made even worse by actually making it real. How can it on the programs? Suicide.
there aren't many occasions where I'm in a room.
How has this company lasted 12 years?
There aren't many occasions where I'm in a room with other people and I'm able to feel smug. Hearing the fact that you two brought the game
you bastard, Carl,
makes me feel a little better about myself. And I will say this,
I didn't own it for long, I just want to state this.
The fact that the main hook to the game was a character called Suicide. I think that's a nice bookend for the game, in truth.
Alex said, and high point, the rise of Bully Ray from solid tag teamer to legit main eventer. I don't hate Bully Ray singles heel. I hate the Aces and Eights. Angle.
Yeah, I mean, there was that just initial run when Bully actually, you know, started to give a damn. Where he was actually really good, and like he had like certain matches with Austin Aries as well, which were very good.
Yep.
Yeah, I think you're right. As soon as they did the Aces and Eights angle, for me, that kind of killed Bully Ray. It's just like, yeah, he didn't need that. The whole point of Bully Ray, you know, he's a bully for one, surprise. And the whole point, he's supposed to be a loner. And so as soon as being associated with a group of, you know, idiotic bikers from the WWE,
a group of no marks, let's call them what they are, yeah, a group of no marks.
Freaking Knox and.
Low points. Sting vs. Jeff Hardy from Victory Road. You'll be hearing a lot of that on this show. Chris Hill, hi, using legitimately awesome wrestlers as top talent, such as Joe, AJ, Daniels, Aries, Rude, and Abyss. One name is not like the others on that list.
One name does not belong, and we'll let the listeners work out which one.
And Low, the terrible use of them when they're on top. And the focus on Hogan, Jarrett, Sting, and Nash. Jonathan Ashley mentions, hi, X Division, Low, Sting vs. Jeff Hardy, again. X Division, in terms of broad strokes, I think that there's probably a lot more periods of time when the X Division was looked at as, why can't it be what it was, or why can't it be as good as it could be?
Yeah, very much. It got off to an excellent start.
Yeah,
with,
it did.
With the Styles, Jerry Lee, and that sort of thing. I think it even
Loki too.
Loki, yeah. I think Daniels. I think it even worked. I'm not the biggest Chris Sabin fan in the world, but it worked with Sabin, yeah. PT Williams, that sort of thing. But I think it even worked when Joe held the belt. It still worked,
yeah.
Even with Joe, because it's the whole, this isn't about weight limits, it's about no limits sort of thing. But after 2004, 2005, after that, I don't think the X Division's really meant much. Outside of the Ultimate X match,
yeah,
really.
It wasn't long after that initial period where they were putting the X Division over, where they did that whole, like for several months, Team 3D just buried the entire X Division, where they just beat up
Kevin
everybody.
Nash.
We can't talk about bearers of the X Division without getting to Kevin Nash, and I'm going to let Kieran come in because I think he's got something good.
Yeah, but come on, give credit where credit's
due. Leave him alone.
Leave him alone.
The Triple H defense, as we call it.
We've moved on from that. Well, I have. There was that beautiful moment when he's making Jay, what's his name?
Jay Lethal. The paparazzi champion's name.
You go first. Why? Because you're black.
Come on. Oh, all those like little vignettes they did where they were just all trying to win praise for Kevin Nash.
I mention his name now. CSL from TPW Forums mentions the paparazzi championship series, which is what we're talking about. A bunch of completely off the wall wacky videos where Kevin Nash is making the X Division guys just do a bunch of complete buffoonery. Press up contests.
Oh, God.
And just the most ridiculous stuff you've ever seen. It's very humorous, but it sure didn't make that division look too good.
And there was not one person who had the forethought in that booking office to sit there and think, you know what, maybe we shouldn't bury our X Division and put this on TV.
Now, you know what, there's one thing that I want to get to too, because the whole point of Nash in the X Division, before this is pre-paparazzi championship series, I believe, Nash went around, remember the first thing he did, remember the promo he did with Alex Shelley with the graph? It's like he's talking about like how this spike here is me, this one that's slightly smaller is Austin, and this one here is where The Rock dropped off business, you know, stuff like that. We're like saying the X Division guys are a bunch of good wrestlers, basically filler.
It always comes back to vanilla midgets with Kevin Nash.
And I can't let this story end without this one bit. So they do the first match, Nash v Saban. Nash wins, of course.
Yeah.
Building up to the rematch, Nash v Saban.
No.
You know what's coming.
Be fair, Kevin Nash had a medical condition.
He thought he had a heart attack. He fucking had a heart attack. Or he said he hurt himself lifting his son's toy chest. I can't remember what the fucking excuse was. Ultimately, he showed up to the fucking pay-per-view in a wheelchair. Course, yeah, course, yeah. So that Alex Shelley could do the job instead.
He worked with Vince. He learned from the best. The old neck brace strategy works wonders in a wrestling company with a wheelchair.
He was his kid's treasure chest, yeah.
All right, moving along. Just to backtrack to Chris Hill's point earlier, he was talking about the legitimately awesome wrestlers Joe, AJ, Daniels, Aries, Rude, Abyss. LP from Pro Wrestling only submitted a low, and he just wrote Abyss. Carl, this ties into your low. I want to get onto this now because I can just see you chomping at the bit to talk about this.
Let's get onto the under Kane, shall we? Abyss is a complete amalgamation, abortion, whatever you want to call it, of several other characters. And it's never really worked. I've never really been a fan.
I'm not a fan.
By any means. But the biggest black mark I have against Abyss, and probably not just Abyss, it's a big black eye for the company.
This is your low for TNA.
It's my low, and it's the Sting Abyss feud of 2006. I challenge you to find a more wretched, sort of top level, heavily promoted within a company feud in the modern era. It's going to be tough to beat. Throw in the last rights match that led to the Fire Russo chance, which went down in internet folklore. But it's not just the matches that were terrible and convoluted with hideous gimmicks that don't serve any realism in the year 2006. They wouldn't have even looked great in 96. Last rights match, for goodness sake, with a casket lowering from this. They may as well just put TNA in the coffin then and close the lid. But as if the matches weren't bad enough and weren't convoluted enough, bearing in mind during this whole time you have Abyss win the world title from Sting on a DQ finish. Just to add to the layers of bullshit. You then have the storyline to it. We have Sting referring to Abyss by his real name.
Chris, so you know
it's serious. They're shooting folks. Not to get on the Vince Russo tirade too much, but let's just go over it. The real names. Abyss apparently taking the rap for his mother shooting his father in the back three times, as Jim Mitchell liked to tell us. His mother appears during all this. Abyss's mother. No one cared about Abyss before. No one cared afterwards as part of some twisted face turn. Jim Mitchell, as much effort and as eloquently as he speaks in his promos, it made me embarrassed to be a wrestling fan, that feud.
Yeah, and I felt so bad for Mitchell because he does deserve better. Yeah, and Sting deserved better.
No. Sting does not deserve better.
If you're going to bring him in for that role, he deserves better.
Well, I'll say, despite the denials, the way Carl put that whole storyline there, it does certainly sound like a big steaming pile of Russo, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes sir.
Stinks. The thing with Abyss is,
I just got to say this on the storyline. Didn't it turn out that Mitchell was his dad?
Yeah, he revealed that, yeah.
So wouldn't his mom have recognised the dad?
Asking for too much.
You picked holes in the TNA logic there.
Maybe it wasn't him, but I don't know.
The thing with Abyss, from my personal opinion and perspective, when I was watching him like in the early days, I thought he was reasonable. I thought he served a purpose. You know, obviously they wanted the big monster, and you know, going back to a previous comment where they were talking about AJ Styles and Abyss in the cage, and I said that was around about the time when Abyss kind of stopped being useful at all, because it was shortly after that was when they started building up to that Sting feud, and pretty much as soon as the Sting feud happened, he was just dead from then on to me. I really didn't give it a fuck at all.
So you're saying that last rights match was effective then for the career of Abyss?
It really was. I mean, like it's not funny at all. Actually, it's not funny that he is actually a direct comparison of Kane, as if you actually look at the history of Abyss's character, just like Kane, his character's been so changed and fucked up constantly. You know, whether he was the silent monster, and then during this feud, he was suddenly able to talk now. And the whole, as you said, with the whole thing with the mom shooting Jim Mitchell, this character, just as Kane, has been so convoluted, it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
Well, I think the Kane analogy is a really good one, because Kane was god awful after 6 months, and so was Abyss. It's appropriate that the Kane knockoff is just as terrible as the real Kane.
It actually mirrored it, because just like Kane, when Abyss first came in, he was that
unspeakable monster.
You know what, they stole it.
I never bought Abyss as a monster, honestly.
Yeah, I just kind of say, for public record, I've never been an Abyss fan.
Yeah, the way he wrestles, the way he sells, the way he acts terrified about certain stuff, I fucking hate it. I don't buy him at all as a monster.
I think probably to me,
he's the least terrifying monster. Okay. If he bursts in this door right now,
I'll kick his ass.
Look, Liam, nothing says monster like Ricky Morton firing up as a baby face.
I guess probably in those early days, the reason why I probably thought he was a monster is because they kept booking him against the X Division guy, so he's obviously going to look bigger compared to them when he's overweight.
All right, Mike Campbell from Pro Wrestling Only. The high, the two, Joe Styles pay-per-view matches from 2005, and the three-way from Unbreakable. The low, the rest of Unbreakable. BP from Pro Wrestling Only. The low points are legion, but one thing I can't take away from them is that they did Sting and Hogan better than WCW did. It's a low bar, but it's something.
There are two common themes we're coming out with in this podcast. One is a low being the Jeff Hardy incident, and the other is the fact that everyone is filtering through the shit to find little nuggets of gold.
Yeah, I mean, first off, with the Hogan thing, saying that they did a better job than WCW, where Hogan was a heel and he was running TNA into the ground, and Sting spent an entire year trying to get control out of Hogan's hands, right? And then when he eventually does, after about like another few months, he turns around and goes, do you want the power back again? Because I want to start wrestling again. So the guy who was the heel, like, he was trying to get power off, he decided to give it back to him just because Hogan started saying brother again and started tearing his shirt open.
The dumbest baby face in wrestling history.
Okay, on that point, I'll agree with you. He was a dumb fuck.
Mad Dog from Pro Wrestling Only. His high is the same as mine. LAX in the early months was good stuff. They had their own entrance and they would just come out and destroy people. That whole feud with AJ Styles and Chris Daniels was really good, and I think it was one of the best feuds they produced. Likewise, Sting vs. Jarrett was a very good program. Sting no-selling the guitar shot, immediately pinning Jarrett and celebrating with a belt as a dejected Jarrett sat in the ring was the perfect send-off to his era on the top. I'll disagree with Sting and Jarrett being good because it was the wrong feud. Even if it was done well, people didn't really want to see it, in my opinion. Yeah. LAX, however, is my high. I do... LAX was so good. Not at the very beginning when they had Machete in there, if you remember that very short-lived
version.
Machete.
The version when Conan was just running his mouth, Homicide and Hernandez were brand new, the video entrance, Moody Jack Melendez doing the introduction.
Brilliant stuff.
Brilliant stuff. The music was so cool. And they were just, again, the first match they had was Ron Killings and Sanjay Dutt on a pay-per-view, and they just absolutely beat their ass. Looked like this could be the hottest act this company will ever produce. It looked that good. They had the series with AJ and Daniel shortly afterwards, which was awesome. They had a really good series of matches. It just felt like this was hot. This was something. And again, in common TNA lore, they get something. It's going well. We might be able to run this somewhere. It's just a shame because
it's just edgy and real. It's proper pro wrestling. It was something they didn't do, and it just stuck out. Again, seeing it live stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah,
like,
and
big league.
Exactly, a major league act. They produced their own major league act. And again, what the hell happened? It just slipped through the fingers.
Same as Joe. They always bring something in, and as soon as it gets hot, they just have to figure out a way of killing it.
It was topical. It was current. The immigration thing was catching fire in America at the time. So this could have actually been something. And again, just should have been a top act. And the low point for Mad Dog is fucking up Monty Brown. Gee, I know that you want to get into this because you are a Monty Brown fan. Pounce!
Yeah, I was a huge Monty Brown fan, and I think personally, from, again, in previous posts when they were talking about, you know, established TNA guys that they created, Monty Brown was the one that they really fucked over and failed to build, because this guy, for me, had what it took to be a legitimate guy for TNA. I mean, during that time period where they're trying to be an alternative, and this was before they had like all the WWE ex-WWE guys coming into the company, Monty Brown stood out. He had the charisma, he had the look, and the moves as well, and he was very solid in the ring. And in particular, I think the low point that he's talking about is Final Resolution, because up until then, they were building Monty Brown up, and he was getting over. They had him beat Abyss clean in a hardcore match, or Monsters Ball match, whatever they call them. And they go to Final Resolution, and he goes into a triple threat match, a passable triple threat match with DDP and Kevin Nash, which is basically just like the biggest pro you can ever give a guy, to do a passable match with Kevin Nash. So he beats these two, and then goes on to face Jarrett, and you can see it in the crowd. The crowd were waiting for Monty Brown to win that title. They wanted to see it. They wanted to see a new guy, not an old timer. They wanted to see a new guy become the face of the company and push them forwards. Okay, not as a viable competition for WWE, but just as just something different. And guess what, folks? Jarrett retained the title, and it instantly killed Monty Brown. He lost all momentum. He ended up tag teaming with DDP for the next couple of shows before they eventually turned him heel and had him join Jeff Jarrett. And it just, for me, he was just the biggest missed opportunity, because he was a guy that he looked like a WWE guy. He looked like he could be a top star, but the lucky thing is he was a TNA guy, and that's where they missed the boat. They had a guy right there in their grasp who they could have pushed the company around, and they just fucked it up.
It wouldn't be a Squared Circle Gazette radio podcast if Chase didn't say something that I didn't agree with.
No, I always expect
no,
it.
No, there's no, always one.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not going to get all visceral and personal, anything like that. I'd agree with you, he was charismatic. He had a decent look. I always thought his promos were all over the shop. He very much rambled in his promos. I don't think he was very good at hitting points. I don't think he was that good in the ring. And his finisher... his finisher completely relies on the other person to make it look good.
I think quite a few people's finishers also rely on the person who's taking
the move. Yeah, but when, in my opinion, all you've got is your finisher, that's a problem from an in-ring perspective. But with regards to the Jarrett reference, I would argue that was more about a desperation to see Jarrett drop the title than Monty Brown winning it. I think you could have put several other people in that same position and they would have been just as keen to see...
I would almost agree to that to extent, but they had done plenty of times before Monty Brown. They'd done the whole thing where Jarrett held the title for a long time and then he eventually lose it to AJ Styles, I think was probably the main one. But Monty Brown, there was just something different. If you watch that Final Resolution show, there was something different about it. They really thought this wasn't going to be just Monty Brown might win this for a couple of months and then Jarrett will get it back. They genuinely thought...
This is
the new top guy.
But doesn't that have, again, something to do with the fact that they were fed the old guys before that? Before the Monty Brown match, didn't he wrestle Nash? For the title and wrestle DDP, so does that not hark back again? It's the fact that it's someone different. It could be anyone different. It doesn't necessarily have to be Monty Brown.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, those last the couple shows beforehand, they had Jarrett teaming up with Nash and Hall in certain matches, and
that was fucking terrible. The Kings of Wrestling.
Yeah, and they were facing Jeff Hardy and AJ Styles, and the pay per view before that, Jarrett had a ladder match with Jeff Hardy. In which, Jeff Hardy was a popular guy in TNA at that time, but they weren't as much behind him as they were Monty.
Yeah, and I will transition this. Before we do, Kieran, any thoughts on Monty Brown?
Probably in between the two, really. I mean, he's a new guy. When you create your own, actually, semblance of a star, then you should really go with it. Did he have the ability to go long-term in that position? I don't really think so, but that's kind of a moot point. Quite frankly, I don't. Never ran with him the way they should have. The Jarrett thing at that time, it was a kind of a toxic atmosphere towards it. But when the pit would stand up and turn their backs to him.
What was that thing they used to chant? The pick up your hat,
your
coat,
coat just leave.
That was good. Yeah, and to tie that into what my low is, which is Planet Jarrett, which is that whole run of from the very beginning of TNA to at least 4 or 5 years later on, probably 4 years later on, it just seemed like such a vanity project, TNA, where there were so many times when it was obvious. And there's always a place for a main event heel, a strong main event heel. But Jeff Jarrett just was so symbolic of TNA in that, why is this guy a top guy? He had no business being a top guy. I will say that I did love him in his later years as Big Daddy.
Love Big Daddy.
Big Daddy. Him and Karen as a duo. He was very charismatic and he came off really good, a true old school heel. Back in 2002 to 2005, it was just, again, pick up your hat, your coat, just leave. It was, get out of the way, you are a detriment to this company.
But those kind of early periods, like when he had the title, which you're talking about specifically, the Planet Jarrett, Jesus Christ, it was just ongoing. These title reigns at first would just never end, and then I've already just stated what Jarrett did with Monty Brown, but I mean that just went further where they were clearly building Raven up to be a guy who could beat Jeff Jarrett, and Jeff Jarrett clearly didn't want to lose to Raven. So instead he decided he would lose to AJ because he's already lost to him before, so no biggie. He'll lose to him at Slammiversary, and then AJ will lose the title a month later to Raven,
who then lost it back to Jarrett.
Who lost it back to Jarrett, and then I can't remember. He was supposed to face someone else who was going to beat him. I can't think what the name is, but they didn't get him in the end, and instead they had to use
Nash.
Rhino.
It was Nash.
Was it Nash?
Yeah,
okay.
It was Nash, yeah.
Oh, was that he probably had a heart attack or something, or fell over.
It was another excuse.
Was it another excuse? Yeah, he did another excuse, so they decided to do like a battle royal. to do a battle royal, they brought Rhino in, then they had Rhino win, which actually got a big pop at the time, because on that occasion they just wanted someone to beat Jeff Jarrett, and then they take the title off him after 2 days, back to who?
Jeff Jarrett. Number one WWF fan from TPWW forums. High, the Samoa Joe Kurt Angle feud, the booking of Joe during that period. Low, TNA world champion Chris Sabin. Carl, you mentioned you weren't a fan of Sabin. What do you think of this?
It's not that his in-ring stuff isn't good. It's very crisp when he's not injured. But he's just so bland and so dull. I mean, I'm not... He's very much, to Kieran's point about Monty Brown, I don't have strong feelings about him either way, really. He's just there. I mean, to put the belt on him, it doesn't register as enough of a deal to be a low point, in truth.
Yeah, they were blatantly trying to recreate the whole Austin Aries thing from a year before. I mean, Sabin was a really good X Division champion. That was where he belonged. And the world title, it just didn't suit him at all. He just didn't fit in.
Not everybody's supposed to be the top guy.
Yeah, exactly. They were just desperately trying to recreate the Austin Aries thing from the year before, which kind of like, almost in a way, almost devalued Austin Aries as well, because it was just like, just leave that as its own individual thing, its own moment, and do something different with Sabin.
Say, kind of tying this point with the last one about Jarrett as well, and he's, you know, overstaying his welcome at the start of the company. Has, aside from the Angle Joe 60,000-50,000, has who has been the champion ever affected any of their business?
Never.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, Liam, and this is actually somewhere where I'm gonna credit Sting, believe it or not. I think the only other person who's had a sort of a really obvious effect on buy rates, even short term, as short as it was when Sting first came
Sting's
back.
First
didn't
one.
That lead at least to a spike for,
that was
for,
a spike,
for one
yeah.
show for the tag match with Christian and Jarrett and Brown?
Yep, that's the one. Noid from TPWW. Hi, when they managed to get Christian Cage, Kurt Angle, and the announced Hulk Hogan would be coming in, it just had this feeling that the company might build to something and pull itself up. This whole thing of when, you know, TNA's big moments were when they thought something else was going to happen, that someone else was going to come in and
save
the day.
Another golden carrot dangled in the front of the face.
That's all it was, and it needed to be a progressively bigger and bigger name to get any hopes up, and it never went anywhere.
But it's like you said with LAX, where is it? It's the, we've got this, this could mean something. Oh wait, we're too incompetent, we've ballsed it up.
It's low. Oddly enough, it was probably when they did the swerve and had Monty Brown turn heel instead of beating Jeff Jarrett. So tying into your point there, G, it seemed like they missed the chance to make a TNA guy. There were also periods of time during the Hogan-Bischoff era that just played in verse to how I would have loved my professional wrestling to go. It's like TNA had all the markers lined up, but instead of knocking them over, they swerved completely to the side. Drunk. Poignant comments there. Tie this to it to Gian Chase's The High there, when they managed to get Christian Cage, Kurt Angle, and Hogan. You want to mention Christian Cage as your high?
Yeah, that's exactly. My high is when Christian Cage debuted, because for me, I can understand why a lot of people obviously put Kurt Angle's debut as being the high point of these ex-WWE guys coming in. But for me, it was Christian Cage, because everyone that they brought in, all these ex-WWE guys, I kind of put them into three categories. They were either failures in every aspect of WWE, and so they were going to be failures in TNA. Or you had people who were successful in WWE, and then they didn't really want them anymore, like the Dudley Boys and the Hardys. And then you had like the top stars, like Kurt Angle and Sting, Nash, Booker T, all these guys who they thought would actually, you know, spike the ratings. For me, Christian didn't actually fit into any of those three categories, because he wasn't a failure in WWE. WWE did actually still want him at the time when he left. He chose to leave. But he also wasn't a main eventer, so he didn't have that stigma. There wasn't like necessarily a feel like Christian was jumping down a peg by being with TNA, like it was with Kurt Angle. It always kind of felt like Kurt Angle was a little too good for TNA. Cage seemed to be just at the right level, where he was the sort of guy that could come into TNA, help them out, and kind of elevate him at least to the next level, not make him as a competition to WWE, because Christian wasn't at that level himself, but he definitely sort of seemed to bring something. So for me, Cage's debut was the start of when I first actually thought, okay, TNA's actually going to evolve here. And I think was Christian Cage's debut in 2005?
Yeah.
He
debuted the day Eddie Guerrero died.
That for me was just another part of why 2005 was actually surprisingly a relatively decent year for TNA, and it was because of Christian Cage. And obviously, unfortunately, going forwards from that, it turned out that Christian Cage's run wasn't that great, mainly due to, surprise, surprise, booking. How they basically bastardized him. They pushed him to the title too quickly. They kept swapping him back between babyface and heel and so on. So much so where even Christian Cage couldn't stand it anymore and left.
The thing with Christian, whether it was booking's fault or not, him as a babyface top guy seemed to be missing an element. And as a heel, he gained some traction in 2005. Yeah, when they were teasing the match with John Cena that they didn't do, as a heel was clearly his place. They brought him in as the top babyface, and I always think he looked a little out of his depth, Kieran.
No, I totally agree. Wrong position. The other pushing, I think you said yourself, you shouldn't have gone straight in right at the top. No way, because you need to grow within.
You can say that with every person that they ever debuted in that company, is that they always pushed them straight away, and it's like, no, you should have just slowly did it.
Yeah, again, similar to I mean, I love Christian. I think Christian is a fantastic worker, completely underrated worker as well. Maybe it was a reflection of TNA at the time. It was a sign of what it could lead to, but I don't think in of itself Christian was ever going to make a difference. Which, as the previous point I was saying, it's like, did any of these guys ever make a difference?
Yeah, that's absolutely a fair point. I never thought at any point that this was like, oh, this guy's going to suddenly spike ratings, but it just seemed from, at least from a perceptive and from an in-ring aspect, it was going to take it up at least a notch.
Oh, Zombie 1988 from Pro Wrestling Only. The thing with TNA is that they'd have maybe one or two good weeks, followed by horrendous television for months on end. I'm having trouble thinking of a high point, to be honest, because even the good stuff would have equally as much bad stuff. The early days had the Jeff Jarrett never-ending title reign that couldn't be made up for by the X Division or Monty Brown. 2005-2006 had the X Division guys, but had dumb undercard stuff. The main event Mafia era made it impossible to figure out who was face and heel, and the X Division guys got destroyed. The Aces and Eights era sometimes had okay stuff for the short period, with Hardy, Rude, Aries, and AJ being great, but the Hogan BS, the decimation of the X Division again, and the stupid gut check challenge and more. I guess I'd have to go with the Fox Sports Net years. There was X Division action that carried the company, and I didn't hate Team Canada that much. I can't remember the bad stuff as much, probably because it has been so long that I'd pick that. The low point would probably be the current era. Pretty hard to go lower than this, although the Hogan era was pretty bad.
Yeah, the thing about obviously trying to pick a particular era of TNA that was actually solid is actually really difficult. I mean, you and I, Liam, actually had this conversation where I was trying to pinpoint a period of time where TNA was as close to faultless as possible, and it just doesn't exist.
No.
I mean, I kind of named those first five pay-per-views they did, like the proper ones, not the weekly ones, but these proper pay-per-views they did monthly, which Dusty Rhodes was booking, where they were actually like, there was a lot of praise for those, and they did do some good shows and they did have some good matches, but then I instantly remember, oh yeah, they had Johnny Fairplay around.
Yeah.
As well, and
Jeff Jarrett was still on top. The Kings of Wrestling were
around.
King of Wrestling. Randy Savage wandering in.
Oh, Randy.
That's it. Trying to find a sustained period of good television, good pay-per-views, whatever barometer. It's like trying to find a dry spot in the ocean, isn't it? It can't be done.
Yeah.
But I think that's the first time that Dusty Rhodes' booking has been praised in something like 30-odd years.
Yeah. Dusty Rhodes' booking was always good on the short term, and literally that's why I said the first five pay-per-views.
Fake Plastic Trees from Pro Wrestling Only. This is a good one here. The highs? The concepts. TNA had a lot of good concepts that made them stand out from WWE. The X Division, the Ultimate X, King of the Mountain, Gut Check, Global Impact, the Terror Dome, LAX. The champion can lose the title on a DQ, the Knockouts tag titles, the Bound for Glory series, etc. The lows. The execution of the concepts. $1 million ideas mean nothing if there isn't $1 million execution. A good example of this is Gut Check. G is rallying up to the microphone because he's been wanting to talk about this for a while. What happens when you mix American Idol and WWE's Tough Enough? You get Gut Check. And that's not a knock on the idea. Why did it fail? Because TNA put the stakes way too high by promising a contract to the winners of Gut Check. Not only that, but TNA wanted every single wrestler to be presented in the exact same way. Joey Ryan wasn't being sleazy in his Gut Check promo because he was too busy talking about how much of a Hogan fan he was. That pissed me off too. And this was the same for everyone. Personal stories of tragedy and triumph is cool for American Idol, but in a business where people care more about the character than the person, it's time to bring the A-game. Everyone talking in a monotone voice and being on the verge of tears at every time was really lame.
Right, Gut Check. Absolutely right about the execution, and I think the Gut Check challenge and all that, like that Tough Enough ripoff that they were doing, is a perfect representation of that. I mean, everything about that entire angle that they did was just
pathetic. I mean, like, for the first show, who were the judges again? Was it like it was Pritchard and
Al Snow and Ric Flair.
And Ric Flair, right? And so they have Silver, I forget his first name, but
Alex
no one
Silver.
Alec, no one cares. So they had Silver out there, and so the script was supposed to be that Flair and Pritchard say no, and so he doesn't get a contract. Then Flair, in his infinite wisdom, because you know he is the greatest of all time, right, decides I'm going to go against the script and I'm actually going to say yes and give this guy a contract. So Pritchard on the spot has to go, oh, okay, fuck, you got a contract then. And so they go through the whole thing of like he gets reported to the OVW, whatever they had at the time, and then he eventually gets released after a few months. So they get rid of Ric Flair and they replace him with Taz, right? So to really absolutely go unique on this and not completely rip off Tough Enough. And they then go through like all these other people like Joey Ryan, and he decided to do that whole thing where they're going to break down the fourth wall and we were going to show footage of the judges watching his matches, going, I hate his character, I hate it when he's in the character. And just,
he stays in character.
Oh, he stays in character all the time, and it just breaks my
like
fourth
his gimmick.
Wall. Like, yeah. Oh,
Bruce Pritchard in the ring. Yeah, I like your gimmick. You got the Ron Burgundy thing going on. Remember, speaking of gut check, do you remember Chris Louis?
No,
Chris Louis.
No. Who?
Never mind.
No? Okay.
Has he been on the show? But yeah, that whole gut check thing was absolutely awful from beginning to end. Who did that angle make? Anyone at all? No one. It was awful.
JP Chicago from Pro Wrestling Only. A high point was the Storm Harris street fight. Such a great brawl. I think this is the Texas Death Match. I will say, yeah, and you know the match.
Yeah.
This is the thing. This was a great match. It was two guys, the America's Most Wanted breakup, you know, bloody brawl. Fantastic match. Great finish. And TNA on pay-per-view cuts away immediately to another interview. Meanwhile, in the background, you can hear the fans chanting, "That was awesome." Oh, typical yes. TNA. They've got something that was magic. That was a great brawl with two homegrown stars, and they cut away to a Sting promo while the crowd's going crazy. Again, they can't do anything completely right.
Was that what we used to say? They can't do fucking anything
Even
right.
If they get something right, they fuck it up.
I think, is it about 6 months later, Chris Harris is gone from the company?
Yeah,
completely?
Yeah, and he got fat. But the thing is also with that match as well is that right, I think also to point out with the match is that right before it, that match, that whole the last man standing, whatever they had, was to make up for the awful match that they had
before. Blindfold!
Yeah, the blindfold, and they had this in a fucking cage that was so fucking awful that they had to make up for it with this immediate
match.
The
reason it was so bad for those at home who didn't see this match is because the blindfolds kept falling off every fucking 15 seconds because the drawstring in the sacks fell out immediately. So they're just putting this loose piece of fabric over their head that falls off every time they take a bump. The crowd's booing Chang Fire Russo. This is also the same show as the electrified cage match with LAX and Team 3D with the bzzz.
Yeah. And by the way, if you ever do meet an electrified fence, you can climb up it if you're wearing gloves.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I tried to.
That's what Homicide was wearing.
Go ahead, Ken.
I was going to reminisce about my childhood when I tried to electrify our garden fence with a car battery. Don't think it didn't work. I don't think.
Was that to keep out Latin Americans?
No, just the next door neighbour.
Fire Russo.
I don't know what he did to me, but maybe I'd. Most, it's not really an avenue I want to go down. Anyway, speaking of memories I've erased, I'm going to reference this to Liam because he's my memory, if it hasn't come across already. I have the memory of a goldfish and he's obviously Baby Meltzer. What was the match when someone wrestled a blow-up doll?
It was Loki versus Chris Sabin. It was on the show you were at.
Yeah,
right?
No, that's why I'm trying to ask you. What match did I see when there's a blow-up doll?
No,
blow
you're asking him what match you saw.
Do you see
him
now? Do you see why I preface it now with the goldfish comment? Thank you.
It was Loki. I think it was Loki. It was Sabin. Yeah, he did a double stomp, and it was when they were doing the whole jackass stuff, right? Chris Sabin.
Oh yeah, Jesus.
Jay Lethal.
Yes. Yeah. Who and none of those jackass guys even appeared on TNA. Instead, where did they go instead to appear on
the WWE?
JP Chicago, a low was Homicide taking what felt like 20 minutes to climb out of a cage on the impact that went head-to-head with Raw.
Was that when his fat stumpy ass couldn't get his legs up?
Yeah. Is there a more symbolic TNA moment ever than Homicide trying to get out of the arsehole of that cage?
We're climbing the ladder, folks, but we appear to be stuck. It's a metaphor for the company.
Dylan Waco from Pro Wrestling Only. High point. Many of the things I would have picked for highs have already been mentioned, so I'll go with the single biggest thing that kept me watching, even long after the product seemed to be beyond salvation.
Hope?
No. Don West.
Oh.
Don West. To me, Don West was absolutely awesome, both as the crazy guy in the booth marking out for the Amazing Red, who responds and reacts like he thinks wrestling is real, and as the heel who totally buried the truly awful Mike Tenay, did the heel color shtick better than anyone had in years, and literally saved horrid angles and shows with his talking. In 30 years as a fan, the only wrestling show I've ever watched solely for the announcing was heel Don West era TNA, as the promotion was the absolute shits then, but he was so entertaining in the booth I would watch every show anyhow. When they dumped him, I quit watching immediately, and didn't start back up with consistency until Voices of Wrestling wrote me into doing Impact with views for their site this year. Don West was a gem for TNA.
He was. I mean, actually, at the time when you were listening to Don West, when he was like babyface Don West, he was absolutely frustrating. But in comparison to most commentators today, he's practically a brilliant.
I was going to say, wouldn't you just kill for Don West on a 3-hour Raw to keep your interest
but
going?
I mean, didn't that whole like heel thing come about? Because I can't remember the exact story, but something like about they were talking about they had a meeting, I think, with Tenay, where they were talking about the possibility of like, oh, do you think we should go down to a one-man announce team? And Tenay didn't even bother to stick up for his co-commentator. He just turned around and said, yeah, we should just go to just one. And
so he didn't mean himself. He wanted out of there.
And so they ended up using that as the stick that Don West had beat Tenay with.
Again, Russo, you love that real stuff, even though we weren't in the fucking meeting.
And then they ended up eventually getting rid of him anyway and swapping him with the much better, I'm being sarcastic, the much better Taz.
He's fucking terrible.
Yeah. And he ended up being briefly a spokesperson for Amazing Red again, and also hocking merchandise.
You mock that, but that job probably makes him the biggest TNA draw in their 12-year history.
Seriously, he probably made more money for that company than anybody else.
Oh, yeah. Oh, not mocking what he did. It was just the fact that he was supposed to be a commentator, and they just ended up, like, it was essentially a demotion, whichever way
you look at it. I see it as a promotion.
The thing was, wasn't that Don West's background anyway?
Yeah. That's TV, where Russo found him.
TV sales, where he found him. So it's no wonder that he gravitated to that role eventually. And like you say, probably got more money for TNA than anything they ever came up with in a booking meeting.
Yeah. Dylan Waco, for his low point, says, I'd have to say it was when they let their biggest homegrown star and champion leave the company because they didn't want to or couldn't afford to pay him. Despite the fact that TNA house shows were not drawing particularly well with him, AJ Styles went on to draw record-setting crowds for indies all over the US, including topping several shows that did well over 1,000 people paid, something TNA almost never does anymore. I think in terms of this current death knell period of TNA, this slow agonizing cancer death we've been witnessing for the last year and a half, losing AJ Styles has probably got to be one of the more kind of symbolic nails in the coffin.
I think it's more symbolic than it is an actual real sort of death sentence for the company.
Yeah.
The damage has been done by that point. AJ himself, I think, was tainted within TNA. I think it's benefited him just to get the what was it you called it? The TNA stink off him. Is that what you refer to as the TNA? Get the TNA stain off him, as Kieran put it earlier on.
Yeah, definitely the best move that AJ Styles has ever made is leaving that company and going to Japan.
Alucard from Pro Wrestling Only. Hi, Austin Aries winning the title legit felt like a true star-making moment for TNA. Great crowd reaction, great big moment feel. Everything about it went perfectly. Low, Chris Sabin winning the title the year later. This, on the other hand, came off awful in every way. Sabin came off like a joke and was so far away from where Aries was the year before. I do credit Hogan for trying to put over both in similar ways on screen, but it obviously worked much better with Aries. Gary Thompson says the high point is the 2005 Unbreakable, the exhibition title match in the main event. The wrestling in the company was hot then. The low point, Hogan and Bischoff, because they didn't move ratings positively, and since day one, TNA have spent big money on ex-WWE talent who were old and crap. There you go. Whitey Ford from TPWW Forum says, hi, the America's Most Wanted versus Skipper and Daniels cage match from Turning Point 2004. The high point, we have to mention the cage walk from Elix Skipper here at some point at least.
Yeah, I mean, actually at that time as well, that was actually heralded as the greatest match TNA ever had up until the unbreakable triple threat. For me, the great thing about that cage match is they put the stipulation on that whoever lost... it disbands for life. And guess what, folks? They actually stuck to it. Elex Skipper and Christopher Daniels never actually teamed again.
until Vince Russo came up and put them back together again.
Oh shit, did they?
Yeah.
Oh, fucking hell!
And they can't do anything.
Of course they can. My only good point, Jesus.
Stipulations never keep in wrestling, you know this.
Oh, but I generally thought they kept that stipulation.
And in somewhat related news, Whitey Ford's low was Russo Swerve Bonanza. So there you go.
Oh, God. You know, just, I always felt sorry for Elix Skipper. That after, as good a match as that was, and as incredible a spot as that was, and I liked Primetime Elix Skipper in WCW in the dying days. I found him entertaining.
Yeah, the skip over.
It's such a shame that after they disbanded, they did nothing with Elix Skipper. After all that, that spot,
they
that
put him in the diamonds
match,
in the rough.
He became one of the diamonds in the rough.
With David Young! Innovator from TPW Forums. Let's see if we can notice a pattern with his multiple suggestions. Hi, Joe finally winning the TNA World title. Low, Nash costing Joe the title to Sting, main event Mafia forms. Hi, AJ versus Daniels for the world title. Low, 1 month later, Daniels is losing clean to Val Venus in 2 minutes. Hi, Awesome Kong versus Gail Kim. Low, Bubba the Love Sponge. Hi, TNA gets Hulk Hogan. Low, Hogan never promotes TNA. Hi, Joe versus Angle at Lockdown. Low, Nation of Violence Joe, who feuds with then joins the main event Mafia. Hi, Raven wins the NWA title, completing his destiny. Low, Midget beating off in a trash can.
Low in many ways.
Oh God,
that is a great low.
Hi, Bad Influence. Low, Claire Lynch. And G. John Chase, it is your time to step in for the low, because Claire Lynch must be discussed.
Yes. I forgot about the midget beating off in a trash can. That's fantastic. That I might change my opinion. Claire Lynch. Claire Lynch is my opinion for my low, because Jesus Christ. I mean, talking about like AJ Styles just a second ago about how they just like tried to demoralize this guy. This entire fucking angle that they did was just awful. Okay, so let's go through this, folks. So Daniels has some dirt on AJ Styles and tries to tell Kaz, right? Kaz doesn't really give a shit, right? After a while, right, they both decide to come out and tell AJ Styles, hey, we know some shit about you. AJ Styles looks like he doesn't give a shit.
The fans look
like they don't give a shit. So, after a while, they reveal some footage which shows AJ Styles going into a room with Dixie Carter. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The next week, they decide to show some recordings of a telephone call, which they have, which insinuates that these two, you know, are having some little fun, that AJ's showing them the trouser snake. Nobody still doesn't care.
Surge cared.
Surge cared, right? Because he then punches AJ Styles in one hit, and just knocks him out, and then they never mention it again. And then even afterwards, when they drag out this Claire Lynch to explain that actually it's all to do with her, they don't even do the angle where Surge actually apologises for hitting AJ. No, AJ just looks like a freaking idiot. So then they decide to turn around and tell everybody that, okay, I'm not screwing Dixie Carter. Instead, we're trying to help this junkie whore because she's pregnant. Okay? And like it's just getting worse and worse by week by week. And then they decide to try and turn around and claim that AJ's the father and that Daniels is just like, you know, he's just going to constantly wind AJ up. They show the photos of like her on top of a drunk AJ Styles. And none of it is believable. None of it's believable because all the fans in the Impact Zone, you know, they've done their research. They know what AJ's like. And they just knew that this just wasn't right. This wasn't an AJ type of character.
You need to more mention the research they did on Claire Lynch and they found out who
she was. Yeah, yeah, right. So they do the, research. Like, after a while, everybody figures out who Claire Lynch is because they look up that she's actually an actress. And, right, these fucking assholes, they didn't even go to, like, multiple agencies to try and find me the best goddamn actress that can play a junky pregnant whore, right? No, instead, they go to the back lot of Orlando Studios, and she's so embarrassed by it that she ends up freaking quitting, and they have to just go, ah, actually, it turns out it's all a lie, folks. Sorry for wasting your time.
At least we got a conclusion.
Yes, it's the only time we got a conclusion to anything.
Who would have thought that the geniuses that bought you the Abyss Father Murder cover-up could actually go one better with the Claire Lynch AJ Styles baby daddy storyline and a menage a trois with Dixie.
Oh, God.
What a tangled web this company weaves.
Yes, yes. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Folks, I mean, how much lower can you get than that? I mean, that was putrid.
It ain't Breaking Bad, folks.
Just bad.
Moving on from the Claire Lynch pointer, USA USA 1 from Wrestling Forum says the high point is definitely being live on Mondays, and the January 4th show was the most watched show in TNA history. The debut on Fox Sports and Spike TV were the high points. Low points... too many to name, to be honest, but right now is a low point. The roster is the weakest it's ever been, and with AJ Styles speaking against TNA and Jeff Jarrett starting a new company while being a co-owner still, is just crazy. I don't think anybody's going to really deny that right now we're in dire straits situations. Special FNK from Wrestling Forums, the high point is the beer bottle smash by Bobby Roode. Roode and Storm had built up during the Bound for Glory series, both as a face. After Storm beat Angle for the title, there was a match between the two friends / members of Beer Money. Roode used the bottle to smash over Storm's head to win the title and establish himself as a heel.
Yeah, I mean, eventually they got around to it being like good, but I mean, I'm assuming obviously he's talking about the first title wins that they both had.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that... Jesus Christ, TNA fucked that up to begin with before it got anywhere near decent. I mean, the obvious plan was supposed to be Bobby Roode wins the Bound for Glory series and defeats Kurt Angle and hence starts, you know, a well-deserved guy being on top.
I don't like it, brother!
Yeah, and so, yeah, Hulk Hogan didn't like it, so he decides, you know, actually, I think you should probably go with something different. Why don't we go with Kurt Angle beating him clean, and then on the next Impact... we'll have Storm beat Angle in how long? God knows how
seconds.
Long. Seconds. That will bring in ratings.
Yeah, but it got over the Bound for Glory series, didn't it?
Oh, it did, didn't it? God, yeah, just really give it some credibility to it.
I will say that I do think they went the right direction with Rue being a heel as opposed to the top babyface. Storm was far better suited to the top babyface role, but unfortunately, in classic TNA style, they didn't get it right. They built it up. The climactic match at Lockdown, where James Storm loses successfully.
Oh, man.
They bring it back to try and build it up for Bound for Glory, but it's the Lex Express all over again. He lost his perfect window, they built it up, and they bottled it.
That was the whole thing with Aries winning the title. They screwed it over yet again.
Aries was the one they went to because I think they realised we're not getting the heat on this Storm-Rude thing that we bet the house on for a year.
I think it's... very much the polar opposite of the Joe Angle feud. They rushed through Joe Angle, as we said earlier, you know, a feud that should have lasted 6 months to a year, was blown away in 3 months. This one, if they'd have kept it to 6 months, been a bit quicker with things,
yeah,
would have worked a hell of a lot better. They dragged it out, and as you say, the window of opportunity is slammed firmly shut, and, you know, another moment that TNA has that's pissed down the drain.
Well, that's why I'll say that the sorry, Chase. That's why I'd say that the going to Joe and Kurt straight away. Although, in an ideal world, it's not what I think. In that company, we should be happy it happened, because otherwise they would have fucked it up. Otherwise,
they wouldn't have
ended up not doing it. It wouldn't have happened.
Within 2 months, they had Kurt Angle in his fucking underwear on the tanning bed looking for someone who stole his clothes. Remember that episode of Impact?
I agree completely with what you say. It's a good job they did it quickly, because if they didn't, in retrospect, knowing the way the company is, they never would have got there. But that's I don't think you disagree. It's such an indictment of the company that we have to give them credit for that.
Yeah.
Because they're so arse backwards. The promotion is such a clusterfuck at the end of the day that we know they'd have screwed it up.
Yeah, but I mean, even with that angle there, I mean, all those little moments like the beer bottle smash was good and everything. And I mean, yeah, Roode did manage to get a pretty decent, successful title reign before they started to bury him again. But I mean, James Storm, after all that debacle, never really recovered.
GFW Wrestling says that for the low points, personally, I feel since around October, there is just no atmosphere at the shows, which is largely down to staying at the Orlando studios, which I understand. Alongside that, with the brand being severely damaged with poor house show numbers, despite the employees working hard or not, nothing has really gone in their favour, apart from the recent tapings due to the hot New York City crowd, but obviously it's a short-term fix. The great Rick Morris from the FDH Lounge mentions that for the high point, the first Angle v Samoa Joe match with the build that it had, it's one of the few things ever that wasn't a bad retread of another product. Of course, they had to do the very TNA thing of killing the program with immediate mind-numbing repetition. There are so many low points with TNA, by far the worst promotion of all time, of that scope and longevity, it would be hard to quibble with almost any of them. Hence, I'm going to shoot for the one story that embodies all the pathetic aspects of their sad, carny world in one appalling little ball. Taylor Wilde, while working as their knockouts champion, making so little money from the promotion that she suffered the indignity of being recognised working at a sunglasses hut. Even Randy the Ram Robinson wasn't relegated to demeaning interactions with the public until after his prime was finished, but this poor woman endured probably the most emblematic TNA experience of all time. Good riddance to this joke of a promotion, and indefinite sadness to all of their oafish fans.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely brilliant point made by Rick Morris there. I mean, Jesus, the women were really hard done by in that company. I mean, so many of them, as said, were underpaid or mistreated in some way. The Taylor Wilde story just there was well represented. Also, the story of Awesome Kong and Bubba the Love Sponge was also quite a disgrace as well.
ODB was also working as a bartender, I believe, when she was working for TNA.
Yeah, it's just there's so many women that were just on poor contracts and treated worse than the men, which is just disgraceful.
To be fair, Jesse Neal was on food stamps as well.
Yeah, Jesse Neal was on food stamps. Yeah, that was well documented. But it's just like Jesus Christ, it's like, you know, the women getting paid shit. It's almost like the 1950s all over again, where they're getting half the pay of you know, some of these top men that are in the company, like, you know, Nash and Booker T and so on. It's an absolute goddamn disgrace.
It was. I will say though, since nobody actually mentioned this, we probably should say for a high point, the Knockouts should get some play here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
they were a very, very important part of TNA.
They were, definitely. I mean, just as you know, everyone will talk about how key the X Division was, I think the Knockouts were actually just as important for them. I mean, there were so many great feuds and matches that they had with the Knockouts, you know, whether it was the great Awesome Kong Gail Kim series.
That was the best.
Or, you know, Mickey James versus Tara in the cage, which, if I remember right, I think that was the main event, wasn't it?
Yeah, Headline Impact, yeah.
Yeah, and, these women often got, I believe, the best ratings as well on these shows.
With all the money they were spending on all these other guys, it was the Knockouts who regularly were the highest rated point of the show.
I mean, to the credit of TNA, you know, they probably did a better job, they did do a better job than WWE of actually showcasing women. But it was definitely, you know, the women that took it into their own hands. I mean, they had such great talent there, you know, with, you know, acts like The Beautiful People and Madison Rayne, Hamada, Roxy, Daphne. There were so many great talents there that, you know, TNA were able to find and use.
Finally, the final feedback we're going to go with is CJ519 from Pro Wrestling Only, because this is a bit of a different approach. I have a favourite memory, a high point. Me and my father on a family vacation were in Nashville in August of 2003. We went to an original TNA weekly show at the Nashville Fairgrounds. This was back when TNA still had the girls dancing in the cages on the shows. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision to go to the show, and we were able to get great ringside seats. I could be wrong, but I'm almost sure Dixie Carter herself greeted us as we walked in and guided us to our seats. It was the night when Teddy Hart and Juventud Guerrera had a match that tore the house down. But the main show saw AJ Styles face Raven for the TNA belt, as well as a pseudo-War Games match with Jeff Jarrett emerging as the victor. Imagine that. The whole atmosphere was hot. Hell, the American Dream Dusty Rhodes was there as well, which made my dad mark out. Basically, it was a great show, a hot crowd, and the wrestlers put on a great show for the audience. It was one of the best shows I had ever seen live, even with Vince Russo as a main part of the show. There was good there. What's my worst memory? TNA has just seemed insignificant in the last few years. Too much talking, not enough wrestling, I guess. Horrible programs that never went anywhere. They never seemed to be an alternative in the last few years. They just seemed to be a WWE copy and a poor one at that. They made wrestling fans not care about a wrestling show, and that's their problem. That was the final feedback we got from you guys, and I think that's completely a perfect note to wrap up the feedback on. We've stretched the gamut of what everybody thinks here. There were so many people whose feedback we didn't get to, mostly because there were duplicates of things that had already been mentioned, but I do want to thank Lockjaw, Smelly Meatball, Fig Nuts, McLegend, Pac-Man Boy, and Elite Videos for their comments that they sent in. Obviously, we talked about the things that you mentioned. In terms of the final verdict on TNA, Russo has gotten off fairly scot-free thus far.
I hold Vince Russo personally responsible for crimes against wrestling. And those crimes against wrestling have led to my high blood pressure, my receding hairline, excessive bouts of weight gain, and
alcoholism.
Yeah. I blame Vince Russo.
I'm crying in the shower as well.
I'm getting there. Because of the damage Vince Russo has done to wrestling, I personally hold him responsible for my mental breakdown.
I feel so bad for Vince Russo sometimes, because it's got to be pretty horrible to have this many people hate your guts. I feel bad for the guy, especially when you're listening to like Steve Austin's podcast, where he just sounds like the guy who got his dream job, and even though he wasn't very good at it, goddamn, he really wanted to be good, and he just couldn't be, and it just, you know, it's got to break his heart that everyone realizes that he sucks. Therefore, I'm going to pass the judgment. I'm going to fall for Vinny Ruse. I'm gonna fall for
Vinny's ruse.
I'm gonna fall for the Vinny ruse right here. I'm not gonna blame Vince Russo. He was just the guy that was hired to do a job, and even though he sucked, he should have been shit canned years ago. The reason this is all happening is because Dixie Carter hired the wrong people at the wrong time. Carnies who were able to weave their way into her wallet and her mind and her heart. And I know this has got to be the ultimate thing, because Dixie Carter lied to Spike TV about Russo. That's not Russo's decision.
Yeah, it's way too easy to blame Vince, and he does deserve a lot of blame. And yeah, you absolutely hit the nail on the head there, because Vince Russo, at the end of the day, unfortunately for all of us, he's just trying to do a job. At the end of the day, he has to be hired by someone, and that's why, for me, probably the biggest detriment to TNA has been Dixie Carter herself. She has always been the thorn in TNA's side. She's the one that's hires Vince Russo. She's the one that always makes all the fucking mistakes.
Well, yeah, it's like we said before, isn't it? If you know, you hire a paedophile to watch your kids, you're not surprised when you come home and they've got their bums fingered. So. I think, quite frankly, Vince Russo, I'm trying to speak, boys, quite frankly, Vince Russo probably fitting perfectly with their business in general, so good luck to you, Vinny Roo.
And on that note, gentlemen, again, final statements around the table. The book may be closed on TNA shortly. I know that both you, Kieran, and Carl think that TNA is somehow going to survive this as well. I don't know how they're going to survive it. But
it will be a nuclear holocaust. Israel and the Palestinians will start World War III. TNA will still be alive. And some might broadcast on the emergency network for free.
That's what's going to happen. There will be a nuclear catastrophe. The world, for the most part, as we know it, will be wiped out. All that will be left are cockroaches, Starbucks, and TNA will be running shows from the only place left that, ironically, is still habitable, the Gaza Strip.
Okay, I was trying to be a fan for TNA for a long time, okay? As I said, I bought the DVDs, I bought the merchandise, I bought the games and everything, okay? But I just didn't have it in me anymore. And quite frankly, I think that TNA deserves to die. And the reason why I think it deserves to die is not only just for the obvious fact it's so goddamn awful, but it's actually a detriment to the business now, as an industry as a whole. And there's people that will probably turn around and say, oh, you should save TNA, you should save TNA. He goes, no, we shouldn't save TNA, because every time it's around, it makes the business look bad. And it's much worse to have something that makes the business look bad than not having anything at all, okay? I'm actually going to do a weird thing here. I'm going to compare it to an inanimate object, okay? I'm going to compare it to socks. Right, now let's just say that I've never worn socks in my life, and I decide I'm going to turn around and wear socks, and I come across the first pair of socks I find, and they are really badly made, they're shitty colour, they don't fit well, they look bad and they stink and they're falling apart. I'm not going to look down at these socks and think I'm going to keep wearing them because they might get better. They won't get better. You'll throw them off and say I'm never going to wear socks again. And that's what someone who's new to pro wrestling is going to be like with TNA. They'll switch on TNA, see how crap it is, and say I'm not going to watch wrestling anymore. So TNA needs to fucking die just to stop people like this. And people just turning around and saying, oh, you know, but what about the people that need jobs? People are losing their jobs. You know what? Fuck that, right? Those people, fuck that, right? Fuck that comment, not the people, because those guys, if they're talented enough, they will find work elsewhere. They can go to Ring of Honor, they go to Japan, they can work in the UK, in Europe, or even try their hand at WWE. You look at Daniels and you look at AJ Styles when they left. They didn't sit on their asses with their thumb up their Japsai, worrying about where they're going to get the next job. No, Daniels instantly signed a Ring of Honor and AJ instantly went to New Japan.
Natural selection.
If no one gets a job after TNA eventually folds, it's because they're not good enough. And for all these people that just turn around and say, oh, but TNA is a second alternative, you know, it's the second company in the world. It isn't the second company in the world. It's barely the closest second company in America. The second biggest company in the world is New Japan, and that's what you should be supporting, right? If you're looking for a viable alternative to WWE, watch New Japan, because it's different in every way to WWE and TNA. They actually respect,
and
it's actually good. There's actually good booking. They respect their wrestlers. They respect their heritage and the titles. Title changes rarely ever happen, and when they do, they actually mean something. So if you want to support something, don't support TNA. Support New Japan. Watch their iPay-per-views, and guess what? They have AJ Styles over there as well, and he's their world champion. And in the first 4 months of him being there, they've already booked him better than TNA have done in 11 fucking years.
You know, the common cliche of WWE is they try and have something for everyone, whereas in TNA, whenever there was something positive in the show, they went out of their way to make sure there was something to piss off everyone as well.
Yeah.
I think that's, yeah.
It's, if I'm wrong and TNA does go out of business, it's very much just going to be a sort of shrug of the shoulders from me. You want to have a viable number two. You want to have somewhere viable for other people to work and hopefully thrive. It hasn't been the case here. It's a company that never found its identity. In struggling for its identity, picked up too many of the bad habits from WWE and just became almost a bottom-feeding, bargain-basement version of that company. And so I'll look back on, say, 12 years with the odd bright moment, but an awful lot of shit.
I just want to say that when the book is written on TNA, and I think it may soon be, it should be seen as perhaps the biggest missed opportunity in the history of professional wrestling. I don't want to fucking hear any of these TNA fans, or anyone in general, make the misnomer point that Spike TV didn't give him a chance. Because this company was given so much. They had so much money. They had the access to so many potential difference makers. They had a TV deal that they how the hell they even got on Spike in the first place with no track record is beyond me. Spike TV is paying them millions and millions of dollars a year for this show, okay? They've helped with contracts. They've helped with venues. Spike TV has gone above and beyond. So if anyone's saying, oh, Spike didn't do enough for TNA, fuck off. TNA responded by hiring every person on the cover of the Death of WCW book. And if you're expecting a different result, you're an idiot. Again, I think that pretty much sums it up. The biggest missed opportunity, maybe in the history of professional wrestling, and it's tragic that it's come to that. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for the feedback. I am Liam O'Rourke, 4G John Chase.
I'm absolutely exhausted, folk. I'm still thinking about Claire Lynch and it just fucking drives me crazy.
For Carl Jones.
TNA. TNA.
And for Kieran O'Rourke.
Seriously, am I the only person who mentioned Christy Hemme's rack? Adrenaline rush now. Adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush now. Adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush now. Adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush now.